Just a quick check. How many of you are here for extra credit or because of an assignment? Okay. Hey, that's all right. That's all right. I wanted to tell you, when I was a student here, John Kennedy came to campus. And so we had kind of the same experience that you might have had, we all wanted to hear Senator Kennedy at the time speak, and it was over at the auditorium next to the classroom building. Motivation. When you're in education and really care about it and care deeply about how you provide that education to students, you get very interested in the public policy issues that particularly the state and the growing public policy issues that the federal government gets involved in. And most of my career, you know, whether it was in the K-12 system or I was also a professor at Washington State University, most of my career was kind of spent trying to implement those policies that other people passed. And yet from maybe my early days in teaching, I kind of got a thrill every time I heard that the legislature was going into session and had this hope, this eternal optimism that they would come out of the session with something really good for education that would prosper the young people of our state. And, you know, many times they did. It's kind of kosher to criticize what the legislature does and what the majority party has as an agenda, but many times they came out of those sessions and really made quite a difference, particularly for the district I represent, you know, which is made up of 28 small rural school districts. None of them, the largest is the Pullman School District, and it has less than 3,000 students in it today. So, for those kind of districts, they really needed state help in order to function. And so that energy and that motivation and that thrill was there. But I've got to tell you, I got into the legislature more by accident than on purpose. And what it was I had talked to the senior class about their public responsibilities as part of my duties as superintendent when they were getting ready to graduate. And at that time, the issues in Washington were kind of divisive. There was a strong, bright line between Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans had just attempted to impeach President Clinton and didn't do it. And there was that kind of tension around it, and no one seemed very interested in going into a career that involved public policy. And so I talked to him about that, and one young person must have heard what I said. He went home and told his parents about it. And at that same time, the senator in our district had resigned to take a gubernatorial appointment. And they were holding a precinct committee officer meeting in Colfax to nominate people that would run for the senator seat. Both House members were interested in it. And I thought I could make a contribution by making that same kind of talk to the PCOs, because they were pretty discouraged and pretty disheartened about their prospects. And so I had called the chairman and I asked him if I could make that talk. And he said, no, you can't. You've got to be a nominee to make the talk. And I said, well, okay, that leaves me out. And put down the phone, and about 5 minutes later, I got a call from this mother who was a PCO. And she said, Don, I want you to come there. I'll nominate you. You make the speech. And I did, and the PCOs then chose me to go to the county commissioners, and that's how I was first appointed. So the motivation was essentially wanting to do something, particularly about issues in education, and to be a part of that public policy process. It's an exciting process. And you don't know it until you're in the middle of it, how exciting it is. The challenges we're trying to overcome, the divisions, those divisions between Republicans and Democrats are deeper and wider than they should be. Because particularly on education issues, we shouldn't be that far apart. And when I talk to my Democrat friends, and I have a lot of them, we're not that far apart on education issues. The WASL has provided a deep division, but it doesn't cut across party lines. It cuts between party lines, or not between party lines, within party lines in both parties. And so the challenge was trying to help people come together in such a way that, one, they understood education issues, because members who aren't a part of the education committee or haven't been in education can't concentrate on education issues for more than 10 minutes at a time. They're that complex. And so part of it was to try to break it down simply for people. That was a challenge. And the other part was to try to find a coalition that crossed both aisles that was strong enough to oppose sometimes the party leadership in both parties. So I'll stop with that.
Okay.
Thank you. You know, when I came to Whitworth in 1994, which seems like a long time ago, now it makes me feel older than I probably should. But I was a declared business major, and my experience with politics growing up in the Seattle area and going to a private high school was very polarizing. You know, it was a couple of issues, and you were on one side or the other, and that was about it. There was no discussion of theory or policy. It was issue based. And so I ended up in Julia's American National Politics class, unsuspecting, and ended up realizing that I loved theory, and it made a lot of sense to me. And you could talk about how politics affected daily life, and it wasn't this or that, and it didn't fit the box that I'd grown up with. And I realized that I was passionate about it, and I, you know, it coalesced. My interest in politics coalesced at the same time that I realized that the idea of a calling wasn't simply about going into the ministry. You know, I was raised in a evangelical family where the idea of a calling was pretty singularly defined. You know, it was, you were in the ministry. You were a youth pastor. You were a senior pastor. You were a missionary. But God didn't call people to politics. It was not dirty, but it just wasn't as legitimate. And I had to reconcile that with beliefs I had about finding solutions for issues I cared about, low-income issues, housing issues, dealing with, you know, being a steward of the environment, that I realized I was passionate about in college. And so, you know, at Whitworth, I didn't volunteer on any campaigns, and I didn't spend time thinking about how I would end up on Capitol Hill. You know, I spent a lot of time studying, which, you know, I hope that today I realized that I actually remembered. I sat in on a part of Core 250 and realized on the Plato lecture just randomly. And I realized that I'd actually remembered part of it, which was surprising. Not that Plato isn't compelling, but I just, you know, the cave metaphor, that I remembered. And I remember in Julia's class, Julie and I sat in Julia's class and talked a bit about our experiences in D.C., and I realized that a lot of the foundations I picked up at Whitworth, I still use. I used when I was in D.C. And the framework for thinking about social justice is something I picked up here. You know, I look back at my high school years, and I spent summers building houses in Mexico, and granted, it was tied to my church, but I cared about solving social problems then, and I just didn't understand there was an outlet for it in politics. And so after Whitworth, I graduated in political studies and moved to D.C. and worked for a year in AmeriCorps through this program for the Congressional Hunger Center. I spent 6 months in Philadelphia working, driving a truck, picking up food at the port, perishable food that was going to be destroyed, and delivering it to food banks and shelters. I was telling Julia and Julie today, it's a great story, one of my favorite experiences, and one of the exciting ways that I think you can be involved is in direct service and making a difference, is we always got random shipments of food. And I happened to pick up 2 tons of bananas one day, just randomly. And, you know, it's hard to offload a couple of tons of bananas. You know, it's not like you can take it to the grocery store. Only so many shelters can take that bulk of food. And so my partner and I actually drove this truck in the middle of this neighborhood that we knew we had delivered food to before, and just opened the doors and offloaded in this hot fall day, very sticky day in Philadelphia, you know, 2 tons of bananas. And, you know, just all kinds of people. And there was no checklist to make sure you met certain regulations, and there was no, you know, threshold for the poverty level. You were in a low-income neighborhood. So I guess the assumption was, you know, a lot of these people needed food. And that experience really laid the groundwork for me. Not that I didn't want to keep working. You know, I worked for a nonprofit. But that I realized there are larger issues that I wanted to work on. And I realized that politics had a role in solving those. It wasn't that it was all government, it was, you know, or all private sector or not-for-profit sector. But I realized that government had a role. And it had a legitimate role to play in solving some of these problems. And so I went back to D.C. after the fellowship, worked in the Clinton administration with Secretary Glickman at the Ag Department on community food security, and then sort of backed into Capitol Hill. You know, I didn't plan from the day that I left for D.C. that I'd end up on the Hill and end up a staffer. But I had a great opportunity and took it and spent, you know, numerous hours, like every staffer does, sort of working your way up in the system. You know, I spent time answering letters, you know, attending meetings, but finding the issues I cared about during that process. And there are a number that I realized most important to me at Whitworth: housing, low-income issues, race, the environment, and tried to find ways to work on those for the members of Congress. And I think the great thing about, and Julie and I talked about this, our experience on the Hill, and I think it's the same case for at the state level, there are a lot of issues that aren't divisive. You know, as a Washington State delegation, we worked on a lot of issues that mattered for the state. And it wasn't partisan, because we realized that there are certain issues we never agree upon, but so many of the issues were cut across party lines. And so it was an exciting time to be there. D.C. is an incredible place, and you really realize there's a lot of good that can be done for your local district. I had a great member of Congress I worked for who was very passionate about serving his constituents. But it's an interesting balance. I think one of the challenges is really seeing the process. You know, as a Democrat, at the time that I was in D.C., you know, we lost a lot. You know, we didn't, you know, when Bush was elected in 2000, Republicans took all the, you know, they had control of all the houses. And it was a difficult time. And you spent a lot of time compromising. And I think for me, you know, I came out of Whitworth with all these ideals and I had issues, and there were certain solutions, and I knew those were the right solutions, at least I thought I did. And I realized that it was really compromise at the end of the day that was required to make some of these, to solve some problems. And we weren't able to solve a lot of the big problems. And I guess that's good and bad. I mean, I think that's part of the way the total structure is set up. That you can't have dramatic change quickly, and it's incremental. I think that was one of the things, you know, that I learned, and one of the challenges is how to find meaning in that incremental change. As an idealist, as someone who wanted to make a difference, you know, right away, but I had to be content with finding a way to authorize some money for the Tulalip tribe to have an infrastructure system, a water infrastructure system. Even though I didn't have that same feeling of delivering that box of bananas, there was still meaning in it. You know, I never met the tribal member whose house, you know, had potable water, but I knew that it happened. And so that was a very meaningful time. And after, you know, DC, I was lucky enough to meet my wife at a wedding back in Seattle, and I realized that I think a combination of being sick of losing politically and a desire to come home, back to the state, I ended up in graduate school, as Greg mentioned, and during graduate school in public affairs, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking, well, what am I going to make of the things I care about in Seattle? You know, I think it's tough for people who work on the Hill to come back and try to recreate that experience, because D.C. is a very unique place. There's nothing like it. You have the opportunity to be involved in any issue, the opportunity to actually make a difference, to be involved with the member of Congress in decision-making, which you sort of assume you're there as a staff member, but it actually is a unique experience in terms of the amount of power you can have at a young age, for good or for bad. And, you know, I ended up realizing that I couldn't. Well, I took the thing for you. Yeah, I never answered phones, which is good, because I'm terrible at answering phones in D.C. But I guess what I came to realize is that I couldn't recreate D.C. in Seattle, and I realized that I wasn't necessarily always going to be political. You know, it wasn't. The end goal for me wasn't to, you know, get reelected or to run for office. It was to find ways to impact things I cared about. And so I ended up, oddly enough, in real estate by choice and working in sustainable development. I worked for a company and on an initiative called Responsible Property Investing. It's basically looking at making sure that our investments in office buildings and industrial parks are good for the environment, are good for the communities that we build in. And that, and I think sort of to close quickly, was how I found meaning, and it's been a challenge for me. You know, when I worked in D.C. on issues I cared about, I get an immediate response. But making it work in the private sector has been more difficult. You know, I spent a lot of time crunching numbers and trying to find meaning in that, and I've realized that there's just as much opportunity there as there was in politics, and there's a lot of politics in the private sector. And it's been a challenge, but it's been incredibly meaningful to try to make it work.
Is this on? Yeah. Well, I think we're hearing kind of a common theme here, and we heard Representative Cox talk about making a difference, and we talked about Christian leaving Whitworth and being passionate and making a difference, and I think that Whitworth students leave Whitworth with something really unique, and I know I left here with it, and that is, it's just sort of a given that we're going to make a difference. And that's instilled in us for 4 years. And I think I'm going to tie it real quick back to the challenge, because directly related to that is that you're surrounded by people in politics who don't have that 4 years of Whitworth optimism and idealism, as Christian put it. And it's hard to relate to those people some of the time because they're not quite as passionate as you are. And that's definitely one of the challenges that I've felt most. And also losing. It's hard to lose. It's hard to really care about something and work really hard for it for a year or two or three and then have it all come crashing down. And, you know, Christian talks about never winning when he was back in D.C. Well, the times have changed, and Republicans, you don't want to be a Republican in Washington State anymore. So should have waited it out.
I know. I left too early. I had no patience. No patience.
But going back to my 4 years at Whitworth, I think what motivated me, again, I'll echo a lot of what Christian said, the first class I took from Julia, American National Politics, which a lot of you are in, the discussions that go on in there, the theory that you get to talk about, it's a unique experience. And a lot of my friends who graduated with political science degrees from UW or WSU, they didn't have those class discussions, and it wasn't a free-flowing dialogue like it is. So that was definitely a motivating factor. And then the encouragement we got to go out and do internships and service learning. The internship that I got with Senator Slade Gorton's office, which you guys probably don't even remember him, that was so long ago, that's what got me interested in at least the Republican side of politics. I had a great experience. I got to do a lot of things. I felt like I was actually making a difference, and I was hooked immediately. So 3 days after graduation, I found myself on a plane to D.C., and the rest has been doors opening that I've stepped through. Thinking at the time that maybe it wasn't the most perfect opportunity, but I think it's important to realize that what's not perfect at the time can always turn into something that you don't expect. So I think I've answered both questions, hopefully. I want to try and save time here.
Sorry, my fault. Although, a well-kept secret, I also interned for Slade Gorton. While I was at Whitworth, I was one of two closet Democrats in there, and it was quite awkward because every event they had, it was like, you know, the Ronald Reagan Young Republican hot dog feed or something like that. And the Democrats had their own things, and we never got to go to those. But I did wanted to echo one thing that Christian said of young people having a huge influence on Capitol Hill. There was a bill coming up to bust through the SALT II treaty nuclear armament limits that had been negotiated by the president but never ratified by the Senate. And some senior staffer gave it to me and said, hey, figure this out. And so I wrote a very detailed and persuasive memo that he should vote with the Democratic side and not break through, and he did it. So in my experience, clerking for judges and working as a young person in politics is that we pretty much run things there, and the other people are mostly raising money. Probably not at the state level, because I don't think they give you big staffs there to do it. You probably have to do it, but the national scene, it's amazing what young people get to do. I think when I think about motivation, I am both blessed and cursed with an imagination and a bit of a vision as to how things could be better in the world. And Whitworth was a great place to develop that. And I didn't have the fortune of Julia, but I had some other great poli-sci profs, including Dr. Yoder and Dr. Hunt, that, you know, we talked about solutions. And by the time I finished Whitworth, we had most of the world's problems solved. I mean, we did. And I think that was the irony, is that it wasn't that there weren't solutions. There was just no political will to create them. And I think I had that cognitive dissonance in my mind all the time. I'm like, I see how the world could be better, and it wasn't happening. So that motivated me, and also I looked really, really young. I pulled out that picture of Slade Gorton just the other night, and I look younger than anyone in this room by about 7 years. And so no one would listen to me, even if I had a good idea. So I started doing social work, helping high school dropouts, welfare families, disabled vets, try to get jobs in Spokane. And I did that for several years. And I enjoyed doing it, and it was, again, kind of typical Whitworth, let's just save the world one person at a time work. But I was so frustrated by the system. And the biggest frustration was we had a great program. It was a private sector company that did the work. We dressed in suits to do social work. We worked with small businesses and got them to hire our people, and it was great. And yet we could only serve, you know, 1% of the people that came to see us. And I just, something's got to change. And so I decided to go to law school because I thought I would have more influence in the world. And it was true, because when I got out of law school, people still didn't really want to take me seriously or listen to me. But I could sue them. And they would have to come to court and listen to me. And it was amazing. I mean, they didn't take me seriously, but occasionally a judge would. And
I was mostly in doing litigation work. Lots of, I mean, strangely, my minor was kind of peacemaking, and I was a conflict lawyer. And so we've been trashed, the trial lawyers in the world. But really, trial lawyers are conflict resolvers. And people come to us in a fight. We get it resolved. We solve, we settle 95% of our cases without going to trial. People, we get not enough credit for that. So, but anyway, I was doing that work, and I was attracted, though, to big issue cases. And my first big case was actually high school kids in Bellingham who wanted to pray during activity period. And the school said, no, you can't do that, separation of church and state. And, you know, there was great case law that said, no, really, you could, if you guys could think about it. And so I took that case, and my first big, actually, the second argument I had after I had one with the district was with the parents of my kids, because their theology said that Christians could never go to court. And I told them that, okay, I understood that scripture, and there was definitely some merit in that, especially Christians and Christians, I thought, is what it was directed at. But the problem was, if you never are willing to go to court to stand up for your rights, then they'll always vote against you. I mean, the school board was like, okay, Christians won't go to court. Atheists, well, okay. Atheists win. So that was my second battle. Anyway, I was, we won that case. And actually, my favorite part of that is my kids were fairly conservative theologically. And by the end of it, they were spouting off, you know, separation of church and state, but celebration of religious diversity. And if the Satanists want to pray at school, they get to pray at school. And I thought, okay, I've raised a crop of Christian leaders that are going to get religious tolerance. So I did that case. I did a case of juvenile curfews, a case of a magazine that having to do with sexuality and politics that was really controversial, a kid that wrote a poem about teenage killers that got kicked out of school, because he must be one. He wrote a poem about it. And I did those kind of on the side of my regular practice. And then 4 years ago, I took a job here in Spokane at Center for Justice, which is a private sector nonprofit law firm committed to community change. And it brings up the second piece of my driving passion for change and political process. And that is, it's not enough just to be right and figure out the solution. It's how do we create a solution that works for all of us, regardless of what my faith or politics are, what are Jews, if we can find that common ground. And the thing that's so exciting at the Center for Justice is we look at a problem and we try to get it solved in a way that works for people. For example, we do a lot of work in the Spokane River, which is the sixth most polluted river in the nation. And we go to court sometimes to do that. But the problem is, if we go to court and win, and it's unpopular in the community and it costs too much in some people's minds, the legislature will simply pass a law and say, we're going to change the law that you won on, and people can go back to polluting the river. So we're playing really for people's hearts and minds in the Spokane River watershed. So we started a campaign called the I Love the Spokane River campaign. And we don't care if you love the Spokane River because you're a member of the Sierra Club, or you're a fisher person, or you're a whitewater rafter, or you take kids down to the river. We figure out why you love the Spokane River, and we remind you of it, so that when the issue comes up of how much money are we going to spend to clean up the river, that's what's going to be in people's mind. And we apply that to every area we work in. Both poverty law, which we do a lot of work with a lot of, some of you in the audience. I think we have 10 Wentworth students this semester working in poverty law with folks in non, it's collaborative dispute resolutions, best way to put it, is that we work without lawyers to solve problems that poor people are having with their landlords, their employers, their schools. But the other issue that we've been doing a lot on that were in the newspaper is working with the police department. About 12 people have been killed by law enforcement in the last 2 years in Spokane, most of them mentally ill or substance abusing. And the reason is, in my judgment, is not so much that police are angry or bad police. It's that they're not equipped to deal with that problem. And they use old school methodology of dealing with punks, with people who are mentally ill, and it's counterproductive, and people get hurt and die. So we filed some lawsuits around that to get people's attention, but we've also done education. And we've also worked with the police chief and come up with a proposal to have an independent review of police practices. And so that eventually we can kind of step out and that process will self-correct on its own. And those are the kind of solutions that I get most excited about, because we're not just winning a battle. We're not getting an extra legislative advantage. We're not changing the law this time by one executive order so that the next president can change it back in the next executive order. We're actually looking for changes that will affect people. And when that's going on, I get excited. And I just want to say one other little story that kind of epitomizes, I think, what I get excited. And that is, a year and a half ago, we got a new city attorney by the name of Jim Craven, who went to Whitworth. I don't think he graduated here, although he did play baseball. And we started after, he's a mediator by training, and after a month of him on the job, we started meeting, and we meet every month. We talk about all the cases where we're suing each other. We don't solve them necessarily in those conversations, but we do the groundwork so that they do get solved later. And just, we have a new mayor now in town, most of you know that, and just 2 weeks ago, he called me up. We've gone to a new level now. He decided to put one of our attorneys on a task force to solve a problem before it turned into a lawsuit. And so those are the type of things that I love to do.
I think I'll answer the second one, because I do have pretty strong feelings as a Republican about faith and politics and where it belongs. And I think that it's, as a limited government Republican, which I said earlier is different from a Bush Republican for all of you who do not like the president, I think it's very dangerous that the evangelical right has such a hold over my party. I think that they've gotten really good at taking up the airwaves on talk radio and having a disproportionate influence. And I wasn't excited about any of the presidential candidates, still am not really, but I do like Senator McCain. And the practical part of Julia's question is, you know, what are you excited about? What are you scared about? I'm frankly very scared right now that the evangelical right is going to hurt a moderate Republican, independent thinking Republican's chance to be president. So that's a pretty frank answer to the question, but
yeah. I'd like to run a little more of that too. I think Julie brings up a great point, and I think it more on my side, being a Christian Democrat, that, you know, people on my side of the aisle also view Christians in one light. You know, all Christians are like this. There's the stereotype of it. And it really limits, I think, public discourse on the role of faith in politics, because what people see, and I understand part of the left's aversion to it, because what they see is just a very narrow perspective. Not the perspective I had at Whitworth, which is one of the reasons I love Whitworth, because I realized that you could be a Christian and think about faith and politics, and in a way that was not in this little teeny box. Not that that box is illegitimate, because it's my family. They're very passionate people. We don't talk about certain issues anymore, and I think that's better. It's better for our relationship, and we've realized, I think my parents thought I was rebelling for years, and now they realize it's not rebelling, and it's just the way it is. And I realize that I can't change them. But I think what's great about this election cycle is that I think this led up in the last cycle when Democrats realized that they needed to start talking about faith. And I think it's unfortunate that they realized that not because of the value of faith in public discourse, but because it cost them votes. And, there was a panel a couple weeks ago that Tim Russert moderated, and George Will was on it, and E.J. Dionne, and a few others, talking about faith and politics. Or part of it was, I just caught part of it. But E.J. Dionne was mentioning a comment about why he's interested in Obama. And I caucus for Obama. I've been involved with friends working with Obama since he was in the State House in Illinois. And I'm passionate for, you know, my own personal reasons. But one of the things that I really enjoyed about this panel was E.J. Dionne talking about Obama talking about faith and doubt, and talking about faith in a way that was real, and not in a way that was contrived or politically manipulated, that he could sort of question what it meant to be a Christian in ways that hadn't been discussed, frankly, in politics, because I think people are so worried about offending different groups in their party on both sides. You know, Democrats are scared about talking about faith because they don't want to go there, and you know, they don't want to be pegged that way, and it has to be separate. Church and state has to be separate, because if you do, you're going to get this commingling, and it's going to be bad for policy. I don't think that's the case, because I think what we realize is that Americans on lots of different levels care deeply about faith, whether, you know, it's Islam or Christianity or you're a Presbyterian or a Methodist or, you know, a, you know, Christian Reform or a Baptist preacher from, the South. I think the Huckabee appeal is the same appeal Obama has. They're different and they're able to talk about faith and it seems real. And I think that people are craving that because it is important to them on various levels.
Yeah, I'll jump in on the faith because I'm a person of faith and I think faith is so important. And I think why it's challenging in the public discourse is that it's complicated and it's hard and there's no right answer. And so a lot of people want to put you in two different camps. One, never talk about it, you can't talk about it. Or, no, you're going to talk about it, and here is the truth, with a capital T. And the best concept that anyone has shared with me about it is to start talking about your own truth with a little t. Just say, well, this is my truth, and it happens to be my truth right now, because my beliefs have evolved, or I probably should say changed, and maybe they were better before, I don't know. But for me, they're working a certain way. And I think we need to figure out, if we're going to talk about faith and politics, how to create space for your truth and your faith. And if we do that, it can be a motivating factor and not a denigrating factor. Because I think probably the biggest obstacle to my participation in the formal church for about 10 years was what people were saying they were doing in Christ's name. And I was like, well, okay, I'm not going to be with that. And I got over that and am back and active in the church. But I think that is the challenge, is how can we breathe and live and share our faith without fear, yet give someone else space. And I think Whitworth, you know, I haven't been on campus daily for a long time, but the reason I came to Whitworth was promotional materials were come to Whitworth and be a whole person. Don't check your faith at the door. And that's why I came. And I love that experience here of being able to do that. And if we could experience that and create that for others, you'll see, I think, a lot of the divisions go away because everyone will give people space.
Well, it's interesting to listen to this discussion. I wish I could listen to your classes, and I wish I could hear Bill Robinson's talk about faith and politics. But just wanted to let you know, I did have a conversation with Slade Gordon today. I really shouldn't say a conversation. He talked and I listened. That was, and he was a fine man. When it comes to faith, you know, what I found is we could talk easily issues of faith. The House members, the Senate members, didn't matter which party they represented, when we got together and talked about faith, what it meant to us, and how we might hold each other accountable for living out our faith as we practiced this thing called legislation, we could talk easily about that. And there are some wonderful Christians in the other party that both challenged me and made a model for me in terms of how I would go about that work of being a Christian. We could talk about that very easily. That wasn't a divisive issue between us. It only got to be so when we had to work on a specific bill that was generated in part by the pressure from the outside on one party or another. When they no longer could talk about how do we find solutions that are going to work over time, we want this solution right now. That's when we got into vigorous debates and contentious debates. But as soon as that was over, we had a fellowship group that met every Tuesday while we were in the legislature. And staff members and legislators and part of the governor's staff would come to that. And those were amazing discussions. And I think as deep and rich as you can imagine. And I'd always walk out of there thinking, how can I apply that this week? How can I do something in terms of the way I meet constituents, the way I talk to them on the phone, the way I talk to people trying to lobby me for certain things that really show that there's a difference between people who are grounded in faith in the legislature and those who are not. I think what I concluded was that those who had a faith that were part of public policy, whether they were staff or whether they were elected representatives or senators, they had some kind of absolute anchor that they would do. Absolutes in terms of what they would do and what they wouldn't do. And not that we always were consistent with them, but we were able to talk with each other about that on the part of our fellowship that was accountability. I served on the committee and was chair of the committee for the governor's prayer breakfast. And that's kind of a burden on the governor because they have to come after we get a high-powered speaker that talks on issues of faith and politics, and they have to respond at the time really without knowing what they were going to say. And that's really kind of tough on the governor, and sometimes they would wish we would go away and not do that. But it became so important to the members of the legislature that we just kept pushing on that issue. And frankly, the state of Washington is a model now for the national prayer breakfast. It was first started in the state of Washington in 1948. And successive legislators have never let a governor off the hook on it. And that became the model for the national prayer breakfast. It's just really important to have that anchor. Without that anchor, you get involved in the particulars of the issues. And then you find at some point in time that you haven't been consistent with your own beliefs in terms of how you vote. And I've just seen members of my own caucus, I've talked to members of the other caucus, that just agonized over how they were going to vote on certain issues because they didn't have that anchor. They can accept that we disagree, but what they can't accept is inconsistency. And those members on either side that were inconsistent in their voting were those that raised the greatest amount of anger from the other side. And you couldn't predict what they were going to do and why. And so I think it's a huge issue in state politics. Really would want to encourage you following up on what Julie said, to get involved in your caucuses. I don't care which party caucus you go to. I really don't. But if you don't go to those caucuses, what happens is that the extremes of both parties will take over the agenda of the party. They'll come up with the platform. They'll make the candidate subscribe to that platform. And if they won't do it, they won't get support. And so then the candidates have to subscribe to those extremes in order to get elected. And then when it comes time to vote, or time particularly as a chairman of a committee, whether you allow a bill to go through or not, you've got to please a plank of your party that you really don't agree with that care enough to go to those caucuses and get their plank adopted. And historically, that's been the extreme liberals on the Democrat side, and on the Republican side, the extreme conservatives, that virtually take control of the party. If you don't go. And we've got to have young people there to be a moderating influence.